Hello and welcome to the Science Podcast for December 19th, 2008. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, the 2008 Science Breakthroughs of the Year. We also have the Breakdown of the Year, the Phenomenon of the Year, and Areas to Watch for 2009.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the Science Society, publishers of Science Magazine, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. The American Association for the Advancement of Science at www.aaas.org.
Each year, the Science News team puts together a special issue on the scientific breakthroughs of the year. There are 10 breakthroughs, with one being the breakthrough of the year, which is on cellular reprogramming, and we'll get to it at the end. But to start us off, I've asked the writers and editors of this special section to take us through each of the breakthroughs and what they mean. First, with a breakthrough in biochemistry, is Bob Service in Portland, Oregon.
Thanks, Rob. This first breakthrough is all about proteins and how proteins work. In particular, researchers crunched experimental data this year and showed that one protein, which was already a very well-studied protein, does something that they'd never really fully appreciated. It seems to sort of dance between different molecular conformations. That would suggest that it's possible that proteins actually wriggle about until they happen to adopt a shape that allows them to bind to their targets and get to work. In contrast, most scientists think it's the shape of the target molecule that forces the protein to wriggle slightly to adopt a complementary shape before it can bind. Now, this year, in addition to this result, other teams of researchers tracked individual proteins and the abundance of proteins in cells and got some big surprises, too. One team found that a single random molecular event can switch a bacterial cell from one metabolic state to another. That was a big surprise that it was something so small and random that made such a big change in the bacteria. Also, on a larger scale, another team of researchers found that different tissues in the body may indeed be different from one another, not because of which proteins they express, but how much of each protein they express. Still, another team of scientists developed a technique that could provide new insights into development and disease by simultaneously monitoring the abundance of proteins in cells. Now, this team monitored the abundance of some 6,000 proteins in yeast cells, and they quantified how the expression of these individual proteins differed between two different cell types. So you can easily imagine that down the road, someone could do the same thing with diseased cells and normal cells and learn more about how disease affects the cell, or in some cases, how changes in individual proteins can lead to a disease like cancer.
Okay. Well, thanks, Bob.
Sure.
Now, you also covered the breakthrough about splitting water, right?
Yeah, I did. And this is one about a new catalyst.
What's the advantage here?
Well, the advantage here is that it's potentially cheaper than what's out there now. And just to back up a little bit, the overall goal of splitting water into oxygen and hydrogen, which is what makes up water, is to be able to store energy. In this case, you feed the catalyst electricity, and it splits water. So you're essentially storing the energy and electricity in chemical bonds. Later, you can either burn the hydrogen or you can feed both hydrogen and oxygen into a fuel cell and produce electricity again. But water splitting technology has been relying on precious metals, such as platinum, as a catalyst for the water splitting reaction. And platinum is just way too expensive to be practical for large-scale use. This new catalyst is made from cobalt and phosphorus, which are very common elements, so it's potentially a lot less expensive. And the idea here is to, say, use solar or wind power to provide electricity to the catalyst to split water without using any fossil fuels, and then to store the hydrogen and oxygen for when the wind isn't blowing or the sun isn't shining. Now, the technology isn't quite there yet because the new catalyst is still too slow to be practical on an industrial scale. But just getting cheap and abundant materials like cobalt and phosphorus to split water, well, that's a big step towards renewable energy, and hence it's one of the breakthroughs of the year.
Okay. Well, thanks, Bob.
Hey, you're welcome, Rob.
That was Bob Service joining us from Portland, Oregon, with breakthroughs on how proteins work and in splitting water for renewable energy. Now with a breakthrough in cancer research, here's Constance Holden.
This breakthrough has to do with what are called cancer genome projects. These are studies of the entire genetic landscape of specific human cancers, which can provide new avenues for diagnosis and treatment. In particular, researchers can compare the DNA of cancerous cells with that of non-cancerous cells and see the genetic differences. That can provide hints, for example, as to why some patients' tumors develop drug resistance and others don't. It also helps researchers understand how it is that cancer cells grow out of control. Now, the first of these cancer genomes came out 2 years ago, but the output has really ramped up a lot this year, thanks in part to cheaper sequencing technology. Leading the list were reports on the deadliest cancers, pancreatic cancer and glioblastoma, a type of brain cancer. By sequencing hundreds or thousands of genes, researchers found dozens of mutations, both ones they knew about before, but also some new ones. At least 10 more cancer genome projects are in the works, and the expanding catalog of cancer genes reveals some exciting but sobering complexity. That's because the drugs that target a single gene probably won't be as effective against cancer as previously thought. In order to be effective, treatments really need to target biological pathways such as how the tumor develops, how it signals other cells, or how it metabolizes.
Okay, well, thanks, Tansy.
Thanks, Rob, and Merry Christmas.
That was Constance Holden with a breakthrough in cancer research. Now with a breakthrough in particle physics, here's Adrian Cho from Paris.
Hi, Rob. This is a bit more of a milestone than a breakthrough, and it proves that physicists finally have a handle on what's called the strong force that holds particles called quarks together. Those quarks in turn make up protons and other particles, and this year physicists finally precisely calculated the mass of the proton in several related particles. Let's take the proton, for instance. In simplest terms, the proton consists of three quarks with particles called gluons zipping between them to convey the strong force. But of course, quantum mechanics is not something that can be understood in simplest terms. Instead, thanks to quantum uncertainty, myriad gluons and quark-gluon pairs flit into and out of existence within a proton in a frenzy that's nearly impossible to analyze, but that produces 95% of the particle's mass. So researchers started with this theoretical and mathematical description of quarks and gluons called quantum chromodynamics, and then they simplified it. Specifically, they modeled space and time within a proton as a four-dimensional array of points. Think of one of those ball-and-stick models of a salt crystal. That may not sound so simple, and in 4D it's surely hard to picture, but that array, or lattice, makes the problem much easier to solve. Then, in their computer simulations, researchers put the quarks on the points in the lattice and the gluons on the links between those points. Finally, in their supercomputers, they calculated the mass of the proton and other particles to a precision of about 2%. Now, the numbers are nothing new. From laboratory measurements, researchers have known the mass of the proton since the particle was discovered 89 years ago. But the new results show that physicists can at last make precise calculations of the ultra-complex strong force that binds quarks together, which wasn't possible even 10 years ago. Now, the first really precise calculations of more esoteric quantities were done about 5 years back, but by calculating these familiar masses, physicists have shown that they finally have conquered the strong force.
Thanks, Adrian.
Sure, Rob.
Now, you also covered the breakthrough about high-temperature superconductors, right?
That's right. Physicists have discovered a second family of so-called high-temperature superconductors.
Please remind us first what a high-temperature superconductor is.
Okay, a superconductor is a material that, when it's cold enough, will carry electricity without any resistance at all. Some common metals, for instance lead, become superconductors near absolute zero. A high-temperature superconductor works at temperatures higher than physicists have been able to explain, and for the new materials, high temperature means up to about 56 Kelvin, so just 56 degrees above absolute zero. So that's not so hot. In fact, the current record for high-temperature superconductors is more than twice as high, 138 Kelvin. That's still 160 degrees below room temperature, but it's way, way higher than the theory of ordinary superconductors can account for. So in comparison, the new materials, which all contain iron and only go to 56 Kelvin, might seem kind of underwhelming. But when it comes to superconductors, what really matters to physicists is understanding how they work. So the hope is that the new iron-based superconductors might help physicists explain the older ones, which are compounds containing copper and oxygen. And the first question is whether the two families of superconductors work in the same way. So far, some evidence suggests that they do, and other evidence suggests that they don't. That's going to be a tough one to answer, given that physicists don't yet know how either works. But progress could come quickly. After all, in the past 2 decades, physicists have built up quite an arsenal of experimental and theoretical tools for analyzing superconductors. So keep an ear out for more interesting results.
Okay, well, thanks, Adrian. Merci.
Je t'en prie, Rob.
That was Adrian Cho joining us from Paris with breakthroughs on particle physics and high-temperature superconductors. Now with a breakthrough in astronomy, here's Dick Kerr.
This breakthrough is seeing exoplanets, or planets outside our solar system, for the first time. Sure, scientists had already detected hundreds of planets using various indirect techniques, but this is the first year we've got images, pictures of planets. Now, several groups this year have imaged single planets, so one planet per star. But the most stunning of these extrasolar planet images this year is of 3 objects orbiting a star. The star is called HR 8799, and it's about 130 light years from Earth. The planets are 5 to 10 times the mass of Jupiter, and that makes them among the most massive exoplanets discovered. In addition, they orbit at least 24 to 68 times farther from their star than the Earth orbits from the Sun. And that makes them, by far, the most distant known planets from their star, which is giving the theorists fits. They don't see how planets could have formed that far out. Still, there's a lot more to be learned about these exoplanets, about a half dozen of them so far. And in particular, the light coming from them in the infrared as the planets themselves cool down will give astronomers new clues to what those distant planets are made of and how they were formed. And that will certainly keep the planet formation theorists busy. But as to discovering Earth-like exoplanets closer into their stars, so in Earth-like orbits, well, that's probably still decades and certainly billions of dollars away.
Okay, well, thanks, Dick.
Thank you.
That was Dick Kerr with a breakthrough on direct observations of planets outside our solar system. Now with a breakthrough and mystery solved in biomedical research, here's Mitch Leslie from Portland, Oregon.
This year, researchers finally uncovered the mysterious roots of what's called brown fat. The distinction between brown fat as compared with white fat was first noticed more than 400 years ago. White fat stores energy. Brown fat burns fat molecules to generate heat that warms the body. That's thanks to mitochondria, the energy producers in the cell, and brown fat has a lot of them. So, the mystery was how brown fat came to be. Scientists had assumed that both types of fat developed from the same kind of progenitor cell. But a team of scientists discovered that they could turn brown fat cells into muscle cells and vice versa. They did it by altering the expression of a gene, PRDM16. Researchers already knew that the gene helps make brown fat. But when they turned down the expression of the gene, instead of getting white fat, which they expected, they got a long, tube-shaped muscle cell that could even twitch. Then the researchers took muscle precursor cells, so cells that were about to differentiate into muscle cells, and got those cells to express this same gene, PRDM16, when they normally don't. And when the precursor muscle cells expressed this PRDM16 gene, they became brown fat. The discoveries could lead towards new anti-obesity treatments that melt away the bad white fat by finding ways to fire up brown fat, or maybe even transplant it. But that's still a few years off.
Thanks, Mitch.
You're welcome, Rob.
That was Mitch Leslie joining us from Portland, Oregon, with a breakthrough and a mystery solved on the origins of brown fat. Now with a breakthrough in DNA sequencing, here's Liz Panisi.
So this breakthrough recognizes genome sequencing technologies and how fast and how inexpensive they're getting. We're calling it a sequencing bonanza. For starters, using the sequencing by synthesis technology from 454 sequencing, researchers produced the mitochondrial genomes of extinct cave bears and of a Neanderthal, as well as 70% of the genome of a woolly mammoth. Also, with a new, different, and massively parallel sequencing technology by Solexa, now part of Illumina, researchers described the first genomes of an Asian, an African, and a cancer patient. And those genomes, in turn, have shed light on early human migrations, as well as on candidate genes that may underlie malignancies. And then there's a proof-of-concept paper that came out this year in which researchers at Pacific Biosciences reported that they're reaching sequencing speeds 30,000 times faster than today's methods. All they have to do is make it more accurate. But that's for another sequencing bonanza to come. In the meantime, costs continue to drop, with at least one company boasting that genomes for $5,000 each are in reach.
Thanks, Liz.
Thanks, Rob.
That was Liz Panisi with a breakthrough on genome sequencing. Now, with our last two breakthroughs of the year, here's Gretchen Vogel in Berlin.
Okay, so of course, before we get to the breakthrough of the year, we've got one more runner-up that we're calling the video embryo. The video embryo captures the first day of a zebrafish embryo development. Starting with just a few cells, you can see in these videos the movement of roughly 16,000 cells that developed that first day. The breakthrough was in designing a new microscope that uses a laser beam to scan through a living specimen. The new design avoids the bleaching and light damage that typically happens when analyzing specimens this way, and it allows scientists to examine living specimens up to 5 millimeters across, much bigger than typical microscopes allow. The scientists that made the videos also used computers to analyze and visualize the recorded movements, showing how various cells move around the embryo and form various tissues. The hope is that by posting it all on the internet, which they've already done, the website will develop into a full-blown digital embryo, a sort of developmental biology YouTube with contributions from around the world.
Thanks, Gretchen. And the breakthrough of the year?
The breakthrough of the year for 2008 is reprogramming cells. Reprogramming cells means taking adult cells and introducing factors that turn them into other cell types or return them to their pristine embryonic stem cell state. This year, several groups of scientists took skin cells from patients suffering from a variety of diseases, reprogrammed them into stem cells, and cultured them in a petri dish. Essentially, this allows researchers to study diseases outside of the patient. And that's important because most adult cells don't survive culture conditions in the lab. So being able to study them in a dish could eventually lead to new treatments for so far incurable diseases. Someday, it could eventually lead to treating patients with their own stem cells. In addition, one team reprogrammed cells in a different way, without taking the cell back to its embryonic state. Instead, the team prompted cells inside live mice to change from one type of pancreatic cell directly into another. Now, of course, this year's breakthrough of the year, cellular reprogramming, builds on previous research. And in particular, it builds on two previous breakthroughs. The first happened 10 years ago. Scientists in Wisconsin, in the United States, announced that they had cultured human embryonic stem cells. So, cells that could become any cell type in the body. Of course, as the world now knows, getting embryonic stem cells typically destroys the embryo. And so the research sparked fierce debates over bioethics. And in many countries, including the United States, political decisions limited the work scientists could do with embryonic stem cells. The other previous breakthrough that led to this year's achievements happened in 2006 in Japan. There, researchers introduced 4 genes into mouse tail cells growing in a lab dish. The cells then looked and acted very much like embryonic stem cells, and so scientists had a possible way around the practical and ethical questions surrounding human embryonic stem cells. What's wanted, of course, is more breakthroughs so that the reprogrammed cells can be efficiently made and safely used. But that's research for the years to come.
Thanks, Gretchen. Dankeschön.
Bitte schön, Rob.
That was Gretchen Vogel joining us from Berlin with a breakthrough on digital embryos and the 2008 breakthrough of the year, reprogramming cells. You can learn more about all the breakthroughs this year, as well as see a special video about reprogramming cells online at www.sciencemag.org/BTOY2008. In addition to the breakthroughs of the year, this special issue also covers the breakdown of the year. Here with more about it is Elliot Marshall.
Well, the breakdown of this year is the financial meltdown. Now, scientific research did not take a direct hit from the global financial crises, or at least not yet, but scientists are feeling the consequences. Like everyone else. and some research budgets could get caught in the fallout next year. For example, anything supported by an endowment is at risk because the value of investments in some cases in some of these endowments has dropped 20 to 30% just since last summer. Also, governments are losing revenue. In California, Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger just declared a fiscal emergency, saying the state is heading towards, as he called it, financial Armageddon. Even some of the wealthiest private universities, like Harvard, MIT, Stanford, and Rockefeller University, are trimming their plans, putting the brakes on faculty recruitment, leaving jobs unfilled. And companies that need capital to advance new technologies will be pinched. And some biotech companies will disappear, possibly merging or just going under. While federal spending on research has not changed, President-elect Barack Obama and Congress have not tackled the 2009 budget as yet. But they have promised to back innovation and science. Now, many economists describe what caused the crash as the natural end of an asset bubble, which is an irrational run-up in values. Many also fault weak oversight of the financial industry, particularly new types of debt that were widely sold but not well understood. But whether it's labeled as optimism or greed, the appetite for growth got out of hand, and the financial models that underpinned some investment strategies broke down. So it's likely that for years to come, there will be many debates over both how to restructure the finance market and how to prevent this kind of crash from happening again.
Okay, well, thanks, Elliot.
Thank you, Bob.
That was Elliot Marshall with the financial meltdown as the 2008 breakdown of the year. Finally today, the phenomenon of the year and areas to watch for next year. Here with more about it is Robert Kuntz.
The phenomenon of the year is something we're calling European big science. The European Union has done a great job of pooling its resources to create huge science projects, things like the Large Hadron Collider, which came online this year, and ITER, spelled I-T-E-R, a worldwide reactor project that aims to prove nuclear fusion is a viable power source. Now, the EU is about to release a new roadmap for its science projects to come. What's making all this happen is an organization called the European Strategy Forum on Research Infrastructures, which was set up in 2002 to draw up a list of projects the EU should support. Its first roadmap was published in October 2006, and it listed 35 projects, including a database on population aging and a neutrino observatory on the bottom of the Mediterranean Sea. The EU didn't have enough money to build the projects, but it did have enough to support design studies. The idea was to get the projects to a point where countries could decide whether to build them. And it works. The roadmap and the EU infrastructure funding have given several big scientific projects a major push toward becoming reality. And that's why we're calling European big science the phenomenon of the year.
Okay, well, thanks, Robert.
My pleasure.
So what are the areas to watch for next year?
We've picked seven. The first has to do with a race to find a particle called the Higgs boson. If it exists, it will answer some of the basic questions in physics, such as why everything isn't weightless. Most people thought the Higgs would be discovered at the Large Hadron Collider in Europe, which turned on in September. But it broke down and probably will be offline until summer. So now an older collider in America called the Tevatron has a shot. The Tevatron is scheduled to close in 2010, but it may just get enough data to see the Higgs boson first. Another area of physics to watch next year is evidence of dark matter. Mysterious invisible mass out in space. This year, a couple of experiments saw possible signs that dark matter particles were annihilating one another and shooting out high-energy cosmic rays. Next year, there'll be more measurements from a new satellite, the Fermi Gamma Ray Space Telescope, which NASA launched in June. So, more dark matter announcements are bound to be coming up soon, though we don't think scientists will nail it down completely next year. Another area to watch is Charles Darwin's favorite, the origin of species. Nowadays, biologists can look at DNA from plants or animals of different species and pick out all sorts of differences in their genes. The big question for evolution, though, is this. Which of those differences keep them from interbreeding? That's what makes a species. Scientists are finding more and more of what they call speciation genes. That's going to be a hot area of research in 2009, and with Darwin's 200th birthday coming up in February, the timing couldn't be better. Also in genetics, another area to watch is genomes, this time from plants. scientists are analyzing the maize genome, and they're working on DNA sequences of crops such as soybeans and plants used in making biofuels. Also apples, oranges, peaches, and melons. Pretty much the whole produce section. Neuroscience in court is another area to watch. This year at a murder trial in India, the prosecution showed electroencephalograms, or EEGs, a kind of brain scan, as evidence that the defendant remembered committing the crime. It's highly controversial, but companies already offer lie detectors based on another type of brain scan called functional magnetic resonance imaging, or fMRI. Lawyers looking inside your head. Ready or not, here it comes. The last two areas to watch both have to do with greenhouse gases and global warming. First, ocean acidification. The more carbon dioxide builds up in the air, the more goes into the ocean, and the more acidic seawater becomes. That's bad news for sea creatures such as coral reefs and microscopic plankton. So far, people aren't worrying about them the way they worry about polar bears in the Arctic drowning because of melting ice. But that could change next year when there's likely to be a tide of papers confirming how much damage CO2 is doing at sea. And the last area to watch is coming up in November 2009. An international climate summit will be held in Denmark to set a successor for the Kyoto Treaty on Emissions and Climate Change. President-elect Barack Obama says the United States will play a leading role and will push for mandatory limits on greenhouse gases. But Congress will have to approve any deal he makes. And given the tough economy, senators from states that make cars or mine coal might just block anything that's too strict. So those are our areas to watch in 2009.
Well, thank you, Robert.
You betcha.
That was Robert Kuntz with European Big Science as the phenomenon of the year and the seven areas to watch for 2009. If you missed our regular Science Now segment, we'll have a special Science Now podcast next week with a wrap-up of the favorite science stories from the year. In the meantime, you can catch up on the latest science news at sciencenow.sciencemag.org. For now, that wraps up the December 19th, 2008 special science podcast on Breakthroughs of the Year. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine and of AAAS, the Science Society. The content is provided by the news and editorial staff of Science, and Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for joining us.